Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
All right, welcome to another edition of Advantage Connors. Here as your solo host today, Brett Connors. How you all doing out there? Jimmy's busy this week. I'm down in LA, so I'm gonna be driving you solo here for a little while. But just wanted to check in. French Open week one, just a few days in. I'm working it for Tennis Channel here in LA. Had some really good matches. Gael Monfils went 5 in a classic match the other night. Bummer, he had to pull out the next day. He left it all out there. Great showman. But everyone seems to be doing well. Joker and Carlos on the men's side, and Sabi and Iga and Elena on the women's side are all kind of cruising. So we'll get more into that next week when Jimmy's back and kind of dive into what's been going on and maybe preview the finals weekend a little bit. But wanted to take this opportunity to dive into the Advantage Connors archives. Some of our newer listeners out there don't know if you know, but Advantage Connors used to be, the show was on another platform before we joined Cloud 10 and iHeart Podcast, which is where we're at now. We used to do the podcast just on an app on my phone. It was called Anchor, and we just kind of started doing the show for fun. Right before an Australian Open, we did like a preview show, and then COVID happened and we got locked down. So, you know, we were doing the show as a way to kind of stay in touch when we couldn't see each other and talk what was going on and kind of just have a little project to work on. So we have a lot of episodes that haven't aired on our new Cloud 10 platform. You know, a lot of them are just me and Jimmy talking current events. So those probably won't get put back out, but we like to re-release some of our episodes with guests. And that's what we're going to do today. We're talking with Mr. Darren Revelle. He's been on ESPN. You know him from the Action Network now. He talks tons of gambling on Twitter. He's won an Emmy. He's, you know, a sports business analyst. He's always talking, you know, the new angle and how it's affecting ratings or what's the sales or a new product coming online. And so this interview is a couple years old. It's from 2021, I think the spring of 21. It was when NFTs were kind of starting to pop off and go crazy, selling for ridiculous prices. And memorabilia had gotten really big just because everyone was locked down in COVID and everyone was still making money, didn't really have that many expenses because they weren't able to go out. So, you know, the memorabilia market and the NFT market and all these markets that had been kind of dormant and boring for a while, all of a sudden, you know, got new life. And so we thought he was a great person to bring on to talk about some of that stuff. Obviously, the markets have probably changed a lot since then with, you know, the economy and crypto and everything kind of taking a downward turn recently. But nonetheless, it was a really good interview, and we talk a lot of stuff. We don't just talk, you know, that. We talk East Coast sports and going back to some classic boxing and tennis stuff, and he brings some really great stories. So, yeah, just wanted to re-release this one. It's one of the last ones we have not released with a guest, so I hope everyone out there enjoys it, and we will check back in with you next week with Jimmy. So enjoy the French Open, and enjoy Darren Revelle. Talk to you soon. Peace.
Welcome to the show. Senior executive producer at the Action Network. He was a sports business reporter for ESPN for 12 years and CNBC for 6 years. Welcome, Darren Revelle, to Advantage Connors. How are you, Darren?
Hey, guys. How are you? Great to be here.
Yeah, it's a good day. It's a good day. So I've got to just jump in right away. Tell me what you thought of the last, it was my favorite time of the year when March Madness hit. Tell me what you think of March Madness and the result.
Well, I mean, I think anytime you can say sports is, you know, unpredictable. It's like when there was a guy, he didn't bet it last night, but there was a guy who for the Final Four bet $700,000 on Gonzaga as 14-point favorites over UCLA. You know, because he thought $70,000 was easy money, and that guy was sweating. you know, right. And that's why we play these games. And anytime you're sure of it, I mean, just even last night from a betting perspective, people were jumping all over Gonzaga because I think they just wanted an undefeated season to happen. It was very much like 2008 with the Patriots. I was in the locker room in 2008 at that Super Bowl. And the problem from a media perspective is you have to go down and talk to the players. So there was like 5 minutes to go and all of us had gone down and we are standing in the Patriots locker room. And there is no sound anywhere. And we don't have, there's no TVs. We're in the bowels of the stadium. So we all assume the Patriots have completed a perfect season. And then we hear like a roar. And then all of a sudden, all of us are in the Giants locker room. So people, you know, people want that perfection. I think the only time, by the way, where it was like that was probably the 86 World Series with the Mets and the Red Sox, where everyone was in the Red Sox locker room for game six. And then someone comes running down saying, you know, ball went through Buckner's legs and they all go to the Mets locker room. But I think people wanted Gonzaga. They wanted perfection. And Baylor was just unbelievable.
Yeah, Baylor was the underdog, correct? I mean, 4 or 5 points or so?
It was the first time they were an underdog in more than a year in any of their games. Obviously, they were a number one seed. By the way, Scott Drew, the coach of Baylor, he was not strong in basketball when he was in high school. He was actually the number two singles player at Valparaiso High School. So he was a tennis player.
Hey, how about that? There you go. But you know,
probably had some sort of Connors racket going.
The old T2000, I hope. That would be
cool.
Yeah,
exactly.
I'm an old Bruin, and it broke my heart, you know, when they lost in the semis there. They had a hell of a run, and for me, I wish the Bruins would have gone on, but you know, it kind of Gonzaga beats them, you know, in an unbelievable game. And you know, from my standpoint, you know, I was kind of rooting for Gonzaga, because they beat the Bruins and then to go on and to have that perfect season. You're right. There's something about perfect that kind of grabs onto you and says, you know, this, you know, just to say, you know, I mean, they're still talking about the Dolphins' perfect season, back in the 70s,
1972,
right?
And then, you know, it's amazing you have the perfect season in 1972 with the Dolphins, and then you have the perfect season in 1976 at Indiana. There is something to closing in on perfection. And Jimmy, I think you could probably relate to this when you're going through a tournament and you're winning and you're not losing a set. And then when you get to the end, there's a little bit more pressure. That actually happened in 1976 in Indiana. For their last game against Michigan for the title in 76, they were down at the half by 6 points and they were in a tough position. So I think there's something about as you close in on perfection that the vice clamps in a little bit more. And that was, I think, you know, with Gonzaga even down 10, you know, I would have pay-per-viewed to see that locker room, man, you know?
Seems like it's difficult too when you hit like one of those crazy, you know, buzzer beater shots. You know, it's such a high that you have that it's tough to come down and refocus for the next game. And there's a little bit.
Yeah, and I also think the weirdness of not having fans. Not having, you know, that's something. Jimmy, what would you have done on that day in 1991 against Crickstein if you were in a blank stadium?
Take it easy now.
But you were all on the crowd. The crowd got you. You know, like the biggest thing, and this is one of the factors in gambling too. It's like, who are the guys who don't need a crowd, and who are the guys who need a crowd? Like, we've never had to ask this question in sports.
Really good point.
In 20th century sports, like, who's going to be, especially for like now? Obviously, last year for me it was baseball. It's like, who's the guy, like? For me, we're talking about like Mike Trout versus Bryce Harper. To me, Mike Trout is very cerebral, loves the game, keeps inside himself. He's good. But like, if you look at like Bryce Harper, like, no, he needs someone to pump him on. He's a Vegas guy. He loved to pump people, you know, he loves to get that pump up. So this year, obviously, from a fan standpoint, it's been different. But from an athlete standpoint, it's been interesting to see. And I just, it's so weird to see no crowds or crowds of 5,000 people.
Yeah, you know, that electricity and that excitement and that sixth man, if you want to call him that, from the stands, is something that, you know, athletes beg for, you know, really, you know, to have, you know, to show what they have and to have the crowd get behind them and to push them to that next level, you know, to help them come through and to be the champion. You're right. But I also think that champions figure it out and figure out a way to motivate themselves and to give them that themselves, that shot in the arm to go over the top and, excuse me, and to come out the winner. No crowd for me. I love the crowd. I love the excitement even before the match started. The walking through the crowd to the court was probably the most exciting walk I've ever had.
Right, which is also the worst part about giving up Forest Hills for Flushing Meadows, right? I mean that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 42 years old, and I lived on Long Island in Roslyn on Long Island. Didn't admit it. Haven't missed a U.S. Open, but I, you know, I'm not a, what was Forest Hills last year was what, 80 or 81? I can't even remember.
But, no, for last year, Forest Hills was 77 was the last year. And then 78, they moved to Flushing.
Right, so I was born in 78, never had a chance. Now the walk, you know, obviously there's been a lot of things in sports, like as kids of the 80s, you know, like we got to see things, we got to do things that today you never get to do with athletes. Like, I still remember walkthroughs. There were still walkthroughs to the court, right? Like, mm-hmm. But it just wasn't the same as my parents described, you know, like you could reach out and touch, you know, and it with each decade, it got harder to do that. But that's, you know, I part of the reason why I love being a sports reporter and had to be into sports is because of how close I was able to get in the 80s to athletes. I'll never forget, you know, going to a hotel and asking for Tony Gwynn's autograph. And I legitimately, as an 11-year-old kid, had a 15-minute conversation, sit down kid in the hotel lobby with Tony Gwynn. And wow. It's like, God, you know, I just wish that we, and I know it's totally different, but I just wish that athletes and kids were as close as athletes of kids of the 70s and 80s.
Yeah. Those days are over. Yeah.
Yeah, Jimmy, you look at these sporting news magazines and you look at these old things and it's like Tennis Camp, 1975 or whatever. And it's like Connors, McEnroe, it's like $50 for the week. You know, it's like, what?
Yeah, we were killing it.
it's amazing. Yeah, they had football camps and you're looking and you're like, Hall of Famer, Hall of Famer, Hall of Famer, $100 for the week, you know?
Yeah, it's crazy. I love the up close. I mean, we go and practice at when we first went to Flushing Meadows and even at the old Forest Hills, and the people would just be right at the fence. I mean, we go to, you know, to cross sides, and you know, we'd sit there and have a conversation with the fans, which to me, I mean, they're paying their hard-earned bucks to come and watch us play. I mean, they deserve to have that up close and personal, I think. But that all changed in tennis when they had the unfortunate incident with Monica Seles.
Oh God.
And you know, which changed everything. Yeah. Then security started coming and then a lot of other things happened since then. And you get what you have today, but the fans, you know, to have been able to play in front of them. And I mean, talking about fans, you know, we got the Masters coming up. You know,
well, even just before we go on to that
Brett's got to take control of this.
Well, that overhead shot they used to shoot at the U.S. Open with you guys walking or whoever was walking from the locker room to the court.
Yeah.
Had like a boxing feel to it. You know, like Darren said, like you'd be able to almost reach out and, you know, probably not get a high five, but maybe touch the bag or, you know, reach out and touch your favorite player.
Yeah, well, it was. Like, yeah, it definitely was like a boxing.
Yeah.
Entrance. I mean, now they try to do it, but it's just, it's just not that, you know, it's ladies and gentlemen, please welcome, you know, and it's okay, you know, and I'm sitting all the way at the, you know, I see ants on the.
I know. It's huge. A huge, huge stadium now.
Yeah.
So I see your hat, Arnie.
Yep. Yeah. Nice. One of, you know, luckily, he's just one of those guys that I got to interview. And I guess one of the coolest moments that I had in my reporting career is to have an Arnold Palmer with Arnold Palmer. It doesn't really get better than that.
That's so pretty cool.
He was an incredible man and a great ambassador of the game. Both him and Jack are just, I'm sure you've had your dealings with both of them, and just quality guys.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you look back at, you know, in the past, and this is what I like about golf, is the way they treat their past, and they hold them on such a pedestal. Not, you know, Palmer and Nicklaus and Gary Player and Byron Nelson and Sam Snead, and you know the way they treat them and hold them in such esteem, you know, for what they've done, you know, for not only their time but what they've done for the game to where it is now. I think golf does that. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they do that better than any other sport.
I agree. I think tennis is close. Tennis has an issue, though, with technology. So, like, from the racket standpoint, right? So I think golf gets over the technology. So I have a guy, Byron, I have Bryson DeChambeau, who drives it 350 yards. And I think, you know, Jack, if you look at Jack, well, it's just as sweet. It's the swing. And I don't think that current tennis fans appreciate the mechanics of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s as much, because maybe the game is totally different. But I do think from the standpoint of actual, like, you know, treating them and thinking it's the same game, I think you're right on that. You mentioned Gary Player. I used to go to his charity golf tournament, and I was talking to Freddie Couples. And I said, Freddie, and this again, this is like the charm of the 70s and 80s. And Jimmy, I'm just going back because I just want people to understand like how willy nilly it was and how unplanned things were. So I said to Fred, I'm like, all right, so you were at the University of Houston with Jim Nance, roommate, 1980. And then like, I saw like in 1981, like there was some sort of weird thing that went down with you going pro. And he goes, yeah, I was visiting my girlfriend in California, and there was this club that was there, and it said PGA tournament. And I went up there and I said, hey, you know, can I play? And he's like, hey, you're Freddie Couples. You're the top amateur in the country. He goes, but if you play and you take the money, you know, you can't, you're actually turning pro. So Freddie's like, yeah, okay, I'll do it. Like, what? And he tees up and takes 14 grand and then calls his dad, who didn't know he was doing it. He's like, hey, dad, just turned pro. Right. And the dad's like, what the hell are you doing? Like, that was the 70s and 80s. Like, who would do that today? He's the top amateur in the country. He's like, okay, let's play golf. Like, what? Right. And then it was also, I'm sure you remember, you know, all the, with the 70s and 80s and all these small tennis tournaments in between the big tennis tournaments, like at country clubs. Like my grandfather was like the head of tennis at Tamarack, at Woodmont Country Club in Tamarack, Florida. You came in a helicopter, landed on something, you know, in 83, 84, right? And it's like, it was every player was there at a country club. Like, get out of here. You know, this was the best of times.
Yeah, it was a great time. You're right. It's amazing what started it, sports, all sports, you know, and how it started and the ride that it had to get to where it is now. I mean, to go back and to think that you know, the places that we played were just a thought of being built. You know, and then what
it had, there was a court and metal stands. That's
right.
What it was.
That's what it was. Right. In the middle of a cornfield in a lot of places. And, you know, we started drawing fans and people liked what we were doing. And, pretty soon things started happening, and it's grown into what it is today. But it's been fun to see all that, and walking in a 25,000 seat stadium, saying, back in the early 70s, we were walking in a 2,500 seat stadium right back then, and happy to get it, which was pretty cool, though.
It's amazing, because when I told my parents, I said, I like the green pages of USA Today as much as the red pages of USA Today. I stop, right? And that's for us old people who actually read a newspaper, but it was the business section and then the sports section. And mm-hmm. I said, I want to be a business journalist, but I want to cover the business of sports. And my mom, and this was in, 1999, and my mom was like, really? And I'm like, yeah, no one talks about it. It's billions and billions of dollars, and there's no one who covers it nationally. And yeah, it's just been amazing covering it for the last decade, two decades, and just seeing how, if you don't understand the business today, you actually can't be a good fan. If you don't understand why, like, are the tennis players, or the ATP, are they unionized, are they not? Where's the prize money coming from? How do, all this stuff, your owner's capacity to spend, if you're a fan of a pro sports team, how base your compensation matches up, how draft picks back. If you don't understand that, you're just the dumb guy on the radio. Mm. And so, it's been amazing to like be a part of that and follow kind of the rise and the importance of just understanding the business of things.
So did you get into gambling as like a natural progression of that, or have you always been interested in gambling?
So I was only interested in gambling because it got people's attention. So when I went to Northwestern and I was a freshman, and I didn't want to toil in the daily paper, which was the harder paper to do, and there was a weekly paper. And the weekly paper was like scattered on the floor of the bathroom, really wasn't thought of as, it was thought of as a rag, essentially. And I said, well, what happens if I make the sports all betting? And then all of a sudden people started reading it, right? Like, mm-hmm. So it was just my means to relevance. And that's what it was. And, so I covered gambling over the years, a little bit at ESPN, a little bit at CNBC. And so I had gone to ESPN, went to CNBC, back to ESPN. And, I had a little bit left on my ESPN deal in December 2018. And the Supreme Court had basically said, now states can decide whether they want gambling or not. And I'm sitting here in New Jersey, and they're the ones that brought the case against the Supreme Court. And I'm saying, holy hell, New Jersey is going to be the sports gambling capital of the world. And they opened it up in a way that no other state had. There's 27 mobile sports books. In 2020, $6.3 billion was bet on sports in New Jersey, and they trounced Nevada. So I just felt that, I wanted to be in a place where, there was relevance. And I probably do about 80% betting now, which is fine. I mean, part of me was like, are you going to like this? Are you going to give up sports business? But as I still do the sports business stuff on Twitter. And if there's a big story, I'm going to do it. I've been covering the memorabilia world like crazy and I know you want to talk about that too. Just covering how crazy cards and all this memorabilia has gone in COVID has been exciting as well.
Is that turned into be what's old is new? Again?
A little bit. Like, so there's a couple things that happened. When COVID happened, people started cleaning their houses like never before, right? Like, all of a sudden we have time, right? Not only am I 7 feet from my pantry in my office and trying not to be 300 pounds, but I'm also going through my closets and seeing what's in there. And not only that, parents are going through closets and they're seeing things and they say, hey, do you want to keep this? So that's one thing. So that's old is new. This is old. And now I want it. Don't throw it out. And then the other thing is, when every day is Groundhog Day, you have to remember the past that you smiled. I mean, let's be honest here. And so I think there was something to looking back to the days of old. And I think finally it was in terms of buying cards, buying memorabilia, buying things. There's a dopamine rush when you buy something on eBay or you win an auction And to be honest with you, not to make it like an addictive thing, but we needed that too. Mm-hmm. When we don't have normal human interaction, we have to create things that are firing in our head. Otherwise, like, our brain dies.
Right.
And so I don't want to make it like too crazy here, but I do think that some of the collecting and all the stuff that started happening comes out of necessity for us to survive in a world we've never known.
I was talking to Brett about it, and geez, I've moved. I left Illinois when I was a young kid, and I was thinking that when we were talking a couple weeks ago, I had shoeboxes full of trading cards, you know, back from the 50s and the 60s, and I'm just thinking that.
Oh, yeah, you want to throw up. Oh.
Now I do. I'm feeling that now. It's crazy.
But Jimmy, let me make you feel better, okay? If you didn't throw them out, then no one would have thrown them out. And if no one threw them out, they wouldn't be worth anything.
Well, yeah, right? Exactly. I mean,
you have to think of it that way. And just to tell a little story, because this is one of my favorite. You know, in 1952, Topps started making cards, and the 1952 Mickey Mantle became, you know, now the best conditioned 1952 Mickey Mantle is worth about $30 million, okay? Mm. But in 1952, they made two sets of cards. They made cards 1 through 300, and then later in the season, a higher number of cards, and Mickey Mantle was card number 311. He was in the second set. They couldn't sell those. People were bored by the time. Like, ah, it's deep into the season. They couldn't sell those. So it was 10 cents a pack. And then they went to 5 cents a pack. And then they went to 1 cent for five cards. And they still couldn't get rid of them. And they still couldn't get rid of them by 1959. So here we are with 1952 cards. It's 1959. No one can get rid of them. So they brought them on a barge in Staten Island and dumped them all into the ocean. And that's why, you know, a 1952 Topps Mickey Mantle, again, they threw them out. So don't feel bad about you throwing them out. They actually dumped them.
I'm not feeling bad, but Brett's kicking me under the table here. So, what the hell happened? What'd you do that for?
We'll
create our own supply.
What'd
you say, Brett?
I said, we'll just get rid of most of the supply. We'll create our own supply of demand.
Were you a saver of your gear or a giver?
I gave a lot of, every match I walked off, I gave everything away. My shoes, my wristbands, my shirts, everything, and rackets, everything at the end of the tournament. And I gave it away because, you know, charities wanted it. They could raise money. And so, I would be a part of that. And, you know, just thinking back that all the people that have those now, I mean, I hope it does them some good. I hope that it works out well for them. But no, I was not a saver.
So there's two types of athletes there. What's amazing is, like, you know, Michael Jordan, for who he is and how collectible he is. I was sitting in his office 3 years ago, and he doesn't have a pair of shoes. He actually just doesn't care. Yeah. And he was a giver too.
I'm the same way.
And then you have, Emmett, you know, it's like, okay, I won my games. That was it. Emmett Smith, every time he scored a touchdown, you know, get this thing labeled, he's every single ball, you know, I mean, so there's two pieces, you know? Yeah. So, but I try to help athletes, get some. So a couple years ago, I started collecting tickets, and, tickets are special because, unlike cards, they're like photos, but you can carry them around. So they started grading tickets like you could grade cards. And I came up with my 50 events that I had to collect and have the ticket of. It's expensive to get it back. But what I tried to do, and I'm going to do this with you, Jimmy, okay? So what I tried to do is, when I got one, I tried to get another for the athlete. So when Michael Phelps, I said to Michael Phelps, Michael, do you have, when you won your 8th gold medal in Beijing out of 8 events, do you have that ticket? I said, of course not. I said, okay, so I'm going to send you one. I'll send you one. You're going to autograph it for me. That's your price. I give you the ticket. So I'm going to find you one of these babies. Connors Crickstein right here.
Look
graded,
at that.
Graded September 2nd.
Awesome. God, that's unbelievable.
1991. You got the infinity on the back, you know, which is just,
yes,
and it's just so cool because you carry this around, right?
That's like, pretty cool.
Tell me that, like, okay, rackets, and how are you going to keep all this stuff? But when you get it, so my goal is I got to find you a second ticket here. By the way, it's not easy. Like, you would be surprised. You'd be like, well, there was 25,000 people at the U.S. Open that day. But again, as years go on and all these things go on, it's like, you know, there were 90,000 people at the Pontiac Silver Dome for WrestleMania 3 when Hulk Hogan slammed the Giant in 1987. And that was one of my tickets on my list. Well, it took me 2.5 years to find one of those because, again, like, and but that's also the journey, and that's what's cool. And so that's why I love, you know, I have probably a, you know, $5-7 million collection, and the things that I collect are completely unique, you know, really cool. Like,
that's
so I gotta get you that ticket.
I didn't have that that foresight or that feeling that, I mean, I was busy doing it, you know, and I should have, you know, got a towel from everybody.
But hold on. Also, in fairness to you. You were busy doing it. And if you were actually thinking about anything else, you wouldn't have been doing it.
No, that's correct. That was my point.
You were right. Focused.
And he's an individual player. Like Emmitt Smith's got like an equipment guy. Probably
correct.
All the stuff for him. So he's probably just, and you weren't even thinking about that stuff back then.
You're right.
You almost give it to your buddies as like hooking them up. Like, yeah, here, take it. Maybe.
Yeah. So I got, so my pride and joy are my tickets. And then I have a check collection, which is really insane. And people are like, what are you talking about? You collect checks. And you know, basically like 5 years ago, I went to a show, like a memorabilia show. And the guy handed me a stack of checks. And he said, these are Bart Giamatti checks, the former commissioner of baseball. And they're all $50. And I'm thinking to myself, how could they all be $50? Maybe one is like the Pete Rose investigation and the other is you stayed at a Holiday Inn. How could they both be $50? They have different stories.
Right.
And so I realized that people collected checks just because they felt better about the authenticity of the signature, nothing to do with the stories. So I started collecting, you know, so I would reach out to someone and say, I need a Babe Ruth check. And the guy's like, okay. And, you know, I had a reputation for like, he's like, what do you want on it? What are you looking for? I'm like, well, he's either paying for a prostitute. He's either eating too much or drinking too much. Find one of those three and we're good. And he finds a check for me for Babe Ruth, who, you know, Wally Pipp gets a bad shake because, yeah, Lou Gehrig came in and Wally was out and Wally had a headache. Wally was also Babe Ruth's roommate. And those guys pounded a bottle of vodka every night after every game. So don't tell me that guy didn't show up, okay? But anyway, Babe Ruth...
That's my kind of guy.
Babe Ruth filling out a check to the Park Avenue Circle Liquor Shops, which is still on 38th and Madison, New York City, for the equivalent of $15,000. In 1940. Who goes to a liquor store and buys $15,000 worth of stuff? You know, so, you know, or Amelia Earhart getting paying for nose surgery, or John F. Kennedy, his subscription to the Washington Post 3 months before he became president. So like all these weird things, but it's cool. I love it.
Gentlemen, are you ready to take your skincare to the next level? With Father's Day just around the corner, it's time to seize the opportunity. Our trusted partners at Caldera Lab, the leaders in men's skincare, have the tools to improve the skin of the father figures in your life. With their clinically proven products, wrinkles, fine lines, and signs of aging are visibly reduced and a surefire boost to their confidence this summer. Join Caldera Lab for the skincare upgrade trusted by countless men. Use code CONNORS at CalderaLab.com to enjoy an exclusive 20% off their finest products. I know the beating my skin takes as I get older, and I'm looking to do anything I can to reduce any signs of aging. Caldera Lab has everything I need to hook me up and to keep me looking good. Caldera Lab creates high-performance men's skincare products by combining pharmaceutical-grade science along with nature's purest and most potent ingredients. Get 20% off with our code CONNORS at CalderaLab.com. That's 20% off at CalderaLab.com by using code CONNORS. Make father time a thing of the past this summer with the best skincare tools from Caldera Lab.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What do you think has made it so big? I mean, obviously it's the COVID, people are at home and that stuff, but do you think it's the grading, like the process of turning?
Absolutely.
Into investments.
Right. So in the '80s, when I used to collect and I'd run around and, you know, we'd do card shops at all the dingy places like the Ramada Inns and the Don Carter Lanes and the, you know, Jimmy, you probably had a signing at a Don Carter Lanes or something in Florida, you know, every bowling alleys and hotel lobbies, you know, that was the '80s. And so when we had that, we would say, here's this card, this is mint. And then it'd be like, okay, but how do you know it's more mint than the other? Or once grading came and once you could say like, this is, you know, like this is graded and this company says it's this mint. And then you could sell it on eBay and there would be a across the board, your card equals my card if they're both a nine. Mm-hmm. And I think that changed things. And I do think, you know, like even on something like tickets and in autographs, you know, there's so many fake autographs. Right. I mean, and obviously like Jimmy, you know this too. Once you had the scribble at the match, it's like all bets are off, right? Like someone says like, no, I got this at the match. Like, you know, because there's a scribble and then who would be bad at faking a scribble? So, right. So to autograph authentication became, you know, something that was really big. And we realized that 95% of the stars that we had autographs for were fake. This all brought complexity as a sports business. A guy would have a signature, like a baseball player who got paid a lot of money would have a signature for the guy who paid him a lot of money. And then he'd have a hotel signature, right? Like, you know, Barry Bonds had like a BB line, but like for the guy who paid him, it was BARRYBONDS, you know? I think a lot of people collecting cards, and I do think that memorabilia really is an alternative asset class, not to get too complicated, but you know, when you're a guy, I was talking to, I was getting refinancing my mortgage and a guy said, he goes, there's a lot of money moving in and out. And I just, you know, we're trying to be safe here. And I go, I've never missed a mortgage payment, sir. He's like, yeah, I know. He's like, but we're just trying to, you know. And I said, let me ask you a question, okay? I just put like $150,000 into memorabilia. He's like, okay. And I go, what do you think's a safer investment for a return? Doing that or your 0.1% in savings? Like, it's like, you know, as there's inflation and as our money isn't doing anything sitting in a mattress or sitting in a bank, right, these are real alternative asset classes and people want to grow their money and growing their money with fun, something right, they can smile at. And especially in COVID, something that they can build community with is amazing.
Is it here to stay?
I think there are pockets that are here to stay. There are things that, and I always say, you know, if it looks like a bubble, it probably is, right? So you have these modern basketball cards that, you know, come out of a pack and they're obviously like a 10 of 10. You just pulled them out of the pack. It's not going to look like a 1960 card. And they were selling like crazy. And I think that the modern basketball kind of bubble is probably going to go down. And then there's things that people don't understand. So I'll give you a tennis example. So Serena and Federer cards got hot. And the reason they got hot is because when these cards are graded, the graders put out something called a population report. And that population report means how many they graded. So someone would say when this pandemic started, hey, there are these, you know, 2003 Serena rookie cards and very few have been graded. Do you know why? Because before COVID, they were $5 and no one would spend $25 to grade them. So we're so into the minutia and the data that we lose, you know, certain things. And by the way, like this company NetPro made like 8 gazillion cards. And I always love, by the way, to remember, having been in the business long enough, when no one cared. I mean, like they have a stand at the US Open and like it's the most blank stand ever. You know, no one's going up to it. Or, you know, the 1986 Fleer set with Michael Jordan in it is probably, you know, the Michael Jordan card got up to 738,000. And I just remember, and again, this is, I'm sorry, I'm just a nostalgic 80s kid. I just remember that in 1986, basketball cards were just not legitimate. It was baseball. So you had, you would look and you'd have a 50 cent a pack Fleer basketball and 50 cent a pack Fleer baseball, and 100 out of 100, even though I went to see Michael Jordan and loved basketball, you would take that baseball pack. And today, right, and today, a box of those 1988 Fleer, if it's sealed for in baseball, you can get for $15. The box of the 86 basketball sealed, $400,000.
Wow.
It's, you know, so it's like, and it's the same thing like the 1952 Tops. I remember they couldn't give those away in 1986. They couldn't hand, no, they couldn't hand them to you. So I think they're going to be bubbles. But I think there's things that are new. I think sealed music is going to be big. I think sealed toys are going to be big. You're seeing like Star Wars, you're seeing stuff. Whenever there's something that maybe wasn't supposed to be collectible to start and people started opening them, see, video games now are going crazy. Now, it's like, who for Hanukkah and Christmas said, hey, thanks, Mom, I'm not going to open this up. I'm going to put this, I'm going to store this away for safekeeping. This is going to be worth something. But it's like, how many, knowing that it was never conceived as a collectible, the scarcity is just insane. And I have comfort in my collections in things that are so small. So among my 50 on my list, I got my Connors Crickstein, but I also have, I'm like, I want to find the ticket when Newt Rockne said at halftime, win one for the Gipper. How hard am I going to have to look to get that? And I found it, 1928 Notre Dame Army at Yankee Stadium. There's 5 in the world. That I will never have to worry about pretty much anything with that, because there's going to be 5 in the world now. And there might be 4 tomorrow. There won't be 6. There will never be 6.
That's, you know,
the crazy. The other one was, again, I'm like, how am I going to find this? And I love the chase. I said, I have to get Jesse Owens becoming fastest man in the world in front of Hitler. I mean, is just like the most ridiculous thing ever. Hitler has his 1936 Beijing Olympics, and he's doing the whole Aryan white race thing. And a black guy kicks the shit out of everyone in the fastest man in the world race. Like, that's a little bit of a problem. So I got that ticket too. And it's like, again, you look at these things and it's just amazing. So as long as you, when you're collecting, I always tell people, you know, try to zig when other people are zagging. Don't follow. If you follow, you're going to be subject to the people who you're following, right? If a guy is overextended and he bought 50 of these things and you have 3, he's going to want to sell them so he could take money off the table. Then the market's flooded. Then that's your problem.
It's crazy how it's become such a business.
Yeah, you know, like it's not, never even thought of
it's
that.
Not kids at the stores. It's almost guys investing, or, you know, looking at it more as like a grown-up thing.
Oh yeah. And they do have a problem in that, right?
They used to do it for the bubble gum.
The bubble gum.
The piece of bubble gum.
Sure. Tops was a bubble gum company, and they use cards to try to get you to eat their bubble gum. You know, I mean, right. You know,
and but didn't they just sell Tops? Didn't we see something?
Yeah, they sold Tops. Well, a SPAC acquired it for $1.3 billion. And yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I think you have a problem, and I think this is a problem in tennis, and I think there's a problem in college football, and I think there's a problem everywhere. The money is with the adults right now. Mm-hmm. But if you don't get the kids in, you're done for the future. And right. So you have to think about what is the cost of you not getting the kids. So I think about tennis, and I always think about this, and obviously I'm sure you guys have talked ad nauseum about the American men's game and, you know, how it is kind of nationalistic and, you know, people just haven't had a major since Roddick in 03. And it's like, you know, that's just the craziest drought since the beginning of time.
And as you know, your tennis, what's up? I mean, you've been a tennis fan since the beginning.
I've been a tennis fan since the beginning. I used to get day one of the US Open, get my draw sheet, get my mini pencil. And I would put in Thomas Enqvist, and I'd put in the Woodies and the, oh, I'd put them all in. I know them all, you know, and that was great. You know, like that was the best. So, yeah. So, you know, I think I'd like to see kids in the first four rows at the US Open. You know, I've talked to athletic directors about this. You know, they have the donors in the best seats at the football stadiums, and they put the kids in the corner. And it's like, well, then they say the kids don't want to stay. Well, you gave them the shittiest seats.
Right. Yeah, that's the truth.
And then when those people are donors, you're going to say, well, why aren't they here? Because you didn't put them at the 50-yard line and they watched on TV and they don't feel the relationship. So, like, again, that's the catch-22 with cards and memorabilia. Right now, it's like, that's where the money is. But if my kids aren't opening packs, they're not going to be there in 10 years.
Right, yeah.
I used to love going to the qualifiers at the U.S. Open. I went, go on the LIRR and watch, you know, the real guys gut it out. And, yeah. You know, people not realizing, like, when you see that queue next to a draw sheet at the U.S. Open, damn, that guy's played five matches in 5 days. Yeah,
just to get in.
just to get in. And what's crazy is the difference. So when I became a sports business reporter, I said, you know what? I want to follow the 100th ranked tennis player in the world, the 100th ranked golfer in the world. And they have to be able to open up all their books. Man, the 100th ranked tennis player in the world, when I was doing that, was breaking even. I mean, he was Matthias Boker from Georgia. He's the NCAA champion. He was, you know, I went to Lexington. I saw, you know, while he's serving, the Chick-fil-A cow is walking in the background. You know, I mean, it's not exactly the most glorious thing in the world.
No, absolutely not.
You know, you know, so it's so hard. So I've appreciated, I think a lot of people just look at the tennis stars, and I've appreciated some of the journey and been to some of these lower level tournaments and laugh when the guy who covers tennis betting at the Action Network where I work is betting more on the tournament than the poor guy who if wins the match is going to make. I mean, that's ridiculous. Yeah, well,
I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, it seems like tennis is usually last to adapt to a lot of the new technologies or whatever it is. And they've been slow to adapt to the gambling. And I wanted to talk to you. I mean, you say you have a guy at the Action Network. How is tennis viewed overall? Like in your world, is it lagging behind? Is there a lot?
I mean, I think to some it's seen as a good value because it's like women's basketball. It is what it is. The games happen and no one's paying attention to it, especially at those you know, challenger level matches. Mm-hmm. And if you really know down deep and you can research, you got a good chance. And it's pretty simple from a betting standpoint. You know, there are hockey and baseball sometimes can get a little bit complicated. You know, tennis is just pretty much money line. Who's going to win? I mean, that's the big thing. And you're live betting someone who's down two sets to love, you know, come all the way back. There are these tennis is the, because of the conflict of how little some of these guys get paid and that you can bet, you know, things on them. Obviously we've had the Russians and a lot of issues with either people throwing matches because they can make more money by throwing a match than winning it. You know, that's a little bit of a problem. And then there are these courtsiders who sit by the court and try to jump the electronic feed, essentially calling in like what happened, so that if you get a split second early, you can bet on something after the point has been played, but then you can bet it. Right. I mean, like it's crazy. That's crazy. Yeah. So I think there's, it's rife with cheating because of, again, what I said, you know, but I think tennis is a good sport.
How do you get around that? Is there any way?
Well, you look at the college players, right? You'd think that the college players, they would be the most suspect to try to, you know, they don't have, like, for college basketball or college football, why don't you pay them? They're making nothing. Mm-hmm. But what's happened is some of the states have said, a lot of the states actually have said, you can't gamble on college sports in this state because they don't want the guys compromised. I think it's, for some point in tennis, if there's a threshold, there's either got to be a maximum bet on smaller tournaments, or you can't bet those at all. It can't be. I mean, there it's just too easily compromised and too much of a black eye for tennis, I think. It's not, those guys are playing to get up, but I mean, you can't have, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars being bet on guys who are above 1,000 in the world. It just can't happen. And the nature of them playing in New Delhi and in some of these markets, you know, make it a lot more sketchier, because there could be someone on the ground who can easily stop them and compromise them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And some of these tournaments are played in parks, and I mean, they even put like challenges.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I have high hopes for tennis. I mean, when I look at the U.S. Open and I look at Flushing Meadows, and, you know, I see it's like a Disneyland, what they built, you know, the greatest food, the greatest everything. But I just hope that in the largesse that it is and how big it is now, that, you know, the charm doesn't go away. And I feel like, obviously, the women's game, from an American standpoint, has been great, but, you know, from the men's standpoint, I think it's really hurt. And we've said, you know, hey, Jack Sock, it's Tiafoe, it's going to be all these guys, and, you know, they get up, they're moving up, and then it's like we don't get far enough. So I hope and pray that we get there from an American man standpoint sometime soon.
So what you said it, that they make the events like the U.S. Open and a lot of the bigger tournaments here in the United States, they almost make them a destination.
Correct.
You know, for the food and for the weather, for the entertainment.
They should call it everything but the tennis.
that's kind of my point, and then, oh, by the way, there's a tennis match going on too. Is that taking away from the game and the tennis itself?
You know, I think it's a little bit of a distraction. I think from a men's game standpoint, the distraction is almost meant to happen, right? Like, because if you're a fan of men's tennis, men's American tennis, if you want to bring people in, you have to have the distractions, because we're not getting there, right? So you're actually protecting yourself by making a Disneyland around it. But it's much harder to actually get on the court. I want people to love tennis, and this could be, maybe I'm just hypocritical here, but I just think when I see so many people on the big courts and I just want to scream to people and say, just go to the smaller courts and just have some room and sit down on those metal, or stand up in between those two courts and just be at the ball, be at the, mm-hmm. watch the pace of the ball, watch it hit the court, watch the spin, watch, because it's totally different in a big stadium. Really can't enjoy watching tennis 70 rows up. You can't. Right. It's ping pong. It's not. And so I don't know. I always want to tell people, like, you know, just do that. Get as close as you can to great pro tennis. And, you know, I think tennis is always going to be what it is. I think in a way it's like the NHL and hockey. It's like, it's never going to be the biggest, but I think it should just be as good as it could be. And I don't know if it is right now. I know that as a big tennis fan, for the four slams, I'm all in, but you're going to try to talk to me about the Masters or Cincinnati or Lipton or whatever, Miami Open. I'm not there.
Right.
I'm not there.
So what row were you in at the Krickstein match?
I was far up. I was far up. Actually, yeah, I was far up on that one.
That should have given me one of these. I'd have brought you down.
I wasn't the one who said, "I love you, Jimmy."
there was only one.
Yeah, there was only one. I wasn't the screamer, but
the good ticket would be the McEnroe Patrick, because you know so many people left that match early.
Yes,
and then he's had probably 100,000 people tell him that, you know, I was the one who stayed at that match. You know, I was one of the few people who stayed.
The Krikstein match. There was one. Which one went late into the night? I don't remember that one.
Patrick
went late into the night. So I had 30. Correct. And there was a juniors match after that. It was Ricky Becker of Stanford against J.J. Jackson, who was the number one seed in the junior tournament. And Ricky Becker was the number one player at my high school. So my brother and I were there until it was like, it was the biggest mistake I made since going to an 11:30 performance of Dances with Wolves. And I got out at like 4 a.m, being like, what is going on here? they played that juniors match after you guys. And I remember I was there too. So man, I mean, it's just great memories. And, you know, thank you for giving me great memories.
Oh, thanks. And
it was always great, right? September 2nd was always your birthday. Had the
really
cake.
Good day.
You know?
Yeah. Darren, we talked a couple of weeks ago. Brett and I did a podcast and we tried to explain NFTs.
Oh my God. I can do it.
Well, yeah, and we didn't do a very good job, and we had a lot of replies that said, "What in the hell is an NFT?" So, can you kind of
I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it in 2 minutes.
Okay.
So I'm going to start from a high level, but I'll go very slow. Something that is fungible is automatically changed into money. So if I have 2 Bitcoin, that is worth $100,000, right? I could always change Bitcoin into dollars. If something is non-fungible, that means that on its face, it has no worth. I can't take this 1991 US Open ticket, bring it to a bank, give it to the teller, and the teller gives me $10. Now, there might be value to it that someone ascribes, but it on its face does not have value. So an NFT is a non-fungible token that what it is connected to, whether it's a piece of art, again, that might have value by itself, but what it's connected to does not have any value that you could bring to a bank or that you can immediately exchange for money. The reason why it's called an NFT is for security reasons. So you put something on what's called the blockchain. And so there are 49 pieces of art and I own number 7 out of 49. So when I say you own a 1952 Mickey Mantle Topps rookie card, do you own the photo of Mickey Mantle?
Mm-hmm.
No, you don't own the photo of Mickey Mantle. You own the rights to buy and to sell that card, that one card. It's the same thing with an NFT. I could own a highlight of an NBA game, and I have number 7 out of 79, okay? And I don't own that highlight. When it runs on SportsCenter, I don't get a dividend. When it runs on YouTube, I'm not getting credit. But I have the right to sell that one associated with the highlight. So I've covered this every day, and I haven't gotten into it with the exception of one. I think that NFTs connected to games are where money is. So I own a stable of digital horses, believe it or not. And Jimmy, I swear I'm not on LSD right now. Okay. I own a stable of digital horses that race fake races for real money. Okay. Try to stay with me here. They fake breed fake horses and I get real money. Okay.
I picked a bad time to give up drinking.
it's like coming to America when the guy goes, "Son, lay off the drugs." it's hard and it's challenging.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So how did you get into that?
What'd you say? How did I get into it?
Yeah,
because I watch my kids. I have a 7-year-old twin boys and a 9-year-old girl, and I watch them play these games. And, you know, Dad, can I have $9 for a fake jersey on my digital character? You know, like my son thinks he's like building an aquarium. And one day I look at my American Express card and I'm like, it charges me $50 for a virtual shark. I'm like, we got to sit down here. Okay. Cause somehow I got debited for a fake shark in your aquarium.
The Meg.
You know, it's
find a way to make money.
Oh man.
Hey, there's a reason that game Roblox, you know, that my kids play is like, you know, they have like a $30 billion IPO. No wonder $29 billion was from me.
That's crazy. So you raise them, race them.
You race them. The horses. There's all these algorithms, right? Like if you buy, it's just like the real race. If you buy a Nakamoto Japanese horse, you know, like that's the best of the best. And then you have to figure out the distances. And it's in the beginning. So I'm just kind of learning, but I just love the complex game behind it. It's not just, oh, here's an NBA highlight. I own it. I like complex math, data, all that type of stuff and playing that game. Clearly, it's like an adult type game. But these are what's funny is the reason I knew it was something big is there's a bunch of guys who've made $4 or $5 million over the past couple of years just playing fantasy sports. Right? They write that, I know, right? They write algorithms. They select the right lineups. They take advantage of numbers, what people aren't doing. They're playing fantasy sports and they're winning $1 million prize 3, 4, 5 times in a row.
Wow.
Or over a certain amount. These guys got into this horse game and I saw them and, you know, they're starting to figure out how to win every race every time.
Wow.
You know, I mean, that's what it is. So that gave me a little bit more confidence that I was in the right place. But it's hard. I what's weird about the NFT world is I've had friends come to me and say, hey, I bought this piece of NFT art. You know, what do you think of it? I said, do you invest in real art? And they'd be like, no. I'm like, okay, so now that it's digital, you have more confidence that you know what real art is. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. If you have real art and you think you can analyze real art, right? And you think you know the value of real art, fine. Fine. But if you just got into art because there's digital art and it's easy to click a button and spend $5,000 on it, I don't give you a chance.
Didn't they just, one of the women tennis players, didn't they?
There was a tennis player. Yeah, they called it like an NFT because it was sold on an NFT site, but it's basically like a tattoo advertisement. And she was like,
yeah, sponsor, you know, deal or something.
350 in the world or something like that. I think she should work on her strokes.
Yeah. They just threw the word NFT in there because they knew it would grab headlines.
Exactly. Yeah.
So
when you started explaining, I told Brett when we kind of dabbled in it a couple of weeks ago, you know, you lost me at digital. It's hard for me to grab on and to really understand that. I mean, and it seems, you know, you said you can explain it in 2 minutes. I mean, that's 2 minutes to people who understand. I mean, right. It's still hard for me to grab onto something like that.
And then that makes sense. I mean, it's the way that 20-year-olds talk about this metaverse and this digital world and this world that's not in front of our eyes. Right. No wonder it takes them so long to get to sleep.
That's right.
It seems like it's the future, and it's hard to understand because we're coming from the past.
Yeah, now. You know, I've invested in crypto, and it's like. Yeah. You know, but I haven't 5 years ago. And like, you know, Jimmy, you were talking about you feeling bad because you didn't keep your cards. You know, a lot of people have the fear of missing out that they didn't get in on crypto. And, you know, now all of a sudden people have fortunes on it. But, you know, I go back to like in 2014 when someone said to me, you know, you invest in crypto. And I say, let me ask you a question. What happens if someone comes up to you and says, hey, there's this company. Don't know if it has a CEO. Don't know if there are any earnings. Don't know anything about it. You want to put $100,000 in? No, I don't want to put $100,000
in. I've invested
in
a few of those companies already.
I know. Yeah, sounded good in the locker room when you were talking about, there's this great you know, place to eat called Planet Hollywood. You know, let's whatever it is.
Yeah.
But you did actually, you know, you went on your own from a sports marketing, you know, you had your own Jimmy Connors shirts and you did that before other people really thought about doing that. Was that because you didn't like the deals that were coming to you? Or what, I mean, obviously it was at the end of your career, I think like 90, 91, 92. I remember like the, that wasn't a cactus, was it? What was the four, whatever?
It was three J's and C, JC, three J's, three C's.
Why did you do that?
When I first started, I mean, I came and didn't have any money. So when I first came out, I could have been connected with a number of that have turned out to be big time corporate sports companies.
Right. Like an ING?
With Nike or Adidas.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Or whatever. And
yeah, Ilie Nastasi was the first Nike spokesman.
Yeah. And the old Wimbledon tennis shoes, the first ones, I was wearing those also.
Knight offered him stock.
Yeah.
Because he couldn't afford him being number one in the world. He couldn't afford to pay him what he was probably worth. Offered him stock. And because
another disgusting moment.
Hey, listen, I've had a few. I've had a few. So, you know, but you know, I didn't have any money. So I went with I had my own shoes and I had my own clothes and I had, my own racket, my Wilson tennis racket. And so, I didn't get with one company. To outfit me, as I look back, was it a mistake? Yeah, I don't know. I did okay for the time and I was happy with my deals and so forth. Problem is a lot of the companies that I were with went by the wayside and the other ones are still around and still doing gangbusters.
One of the things that I always thought has become ridiculous in the past 15 years is when an agent does a marketing deal for a racket and the racket doesn't work out. Like Maria Sharapova did a deal. I forgot the racket with the O ports in it, where there's actually, holes in the racket. You can't paint those things on. Paint holes. And within 7 months, so one thing that was good about you is you always had the racket that you wanted to play with. And as I started covering this space, and I got in a epic, I wish I had a videotape of it. Damn. I got an epic fight with Leighton Hewitt in 2004 when after he won the US Open 4 or 5, I can't remember. Yonex put out a, something with the racket that Leighton plays with. And then I said, yeah, but that's not your racket. You actually play with the first racket from 3 years ago, but it's painted to look like that. Mm-hmm. And there was a whole back and forth about, no, I use that racket. I'm like, no, actually you definitely don't.
I'm not saying this is hearsay, but I think there was a few Picassos in the past.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. But I mean, you had to find a racket that you could play with and I was lucky. I picked up that the T2000 and I mean, it was just like an extension of my arm. I was lucky. And, when I had to get rid of that racket in the mid 80s, and I think it was 1986, broke my heart and it broke my game. I mean, I never really found it.
Yeah, because you can never get over the lack of weight when that tech changed in 87, 88, and then 1990, when everyone was going it has to be light graphite, you looked at Sampras and he's like, no, I'm going to play with that Wilson profile until the day I die. And that was smart. He had the same racket.
You find something and you stick with it, the game's changed and, that's the way it is. If you're a tennis fan, a golf fan, sports fan, you go along with the changes and you enjoy it just as much, I guess, right?
The game, this is me questioning you as a reporter, so I'm sorry I'm taking this over, but the game definitely did change towards the end of your years. It became a game of power instead of strategy, right? I mean, that.
Yeah, well, the equipment certainly did that. Yeah. With the change of equipment and you know, the days of the imagination of a Nastasi or a McEnroe or changing your game and having three or four ways to play. Not really right after me, but I think more the generation after that, after Sampras, after Curry, or after Chang, after Edberg, after Becker and guys like that. You know,
turned into the 3-rally point in men's tennis.
Well,
which then led to the homogenization of the game. You know, where surfaces are very similar and all the guys.
I mean, I hate to be at 42, the white man yelling at clouds, but having seen the game of the 80s, when to me, it was a more beautiful game.
Well, I look back, I was privileged to be a part of it when I was playing and with the guys that I grew up with and, you know, who were all their own characters and had their own personality and their own style of game and what they did at that time over those 10, 12, 15 years to help move the game forward was so much fun. And still friends with some of them today, but, we get older and life changes. So, you know, we kind of all go on, we all move on.
It's amazing.
It's been a blast being with you.
This was a treat for me, you know, lifelong fan. And, I'm getting you that ticket's going to arrive. I'm getting you that ticket. You need that ticket. I'm going to slab it up nice for you. And at least you'll have one thing from, you know, one of your, you know, the funny thing, you know, Crickstein got out of tennis and then he became an exotic fish salesman, which was kind of crazy. Cause I was looking him up, trying to talk to him. And I was like, wow, he became an exotic fish salesman. Wow, that's something different. I got one more thing that I forgot to tell you on the checks because it's a treat. So I have the greatest football coach of all time paying one of the greatest tennis coaches of all time for a tennis lesson. I have Vince Lombardi paying Nick Bollettieri for a tennis lesson. And I got it in an auction and I called up Nick and I said, Nick, I got a treat for you. He goes, what do you got? I said, I have something that I got to know what the real story is. So you're going to help me get to the bottom of it. I got Vince Lombardi paying you for a tennis lesson. And, you know, Nick's getting up there, but he said to me, I know what year it is. And I go, get out of here. He goes, oh, I know what year it is. I said, what year was it? He goes, it's 1964. I go, it is 1964. You are right. He goes, really? I said, now, why would you know that? He goes, because in 1964, I was in Puerto Rico as the tennis coach of the Rockefellers and Vince Lombardi came to visit. And I go, well, you still haven't answered the question because if you were the tennis coach of the Rockefellers, what the hell is Vince Lombardi paying you $17.64 for a tennis lesson? The Rockefellers didn't take care of you? You needed that $17.64?
Hey, every little bit.
That's a great one. That's also another wacko one that I cherish. But it was a pleasure talking to you guys. I've enjoyed this immensely. And let's stay in touch.
Love awesome. To.
Yeah.
Good being with you. Thanks, Darren.
You got it.
Thank you.
Take care.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.